Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on 20 small private businesses right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, or multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in employment, and it's certainly not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. It is not in public business, and it's certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's why I contend that it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract, and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for information on our CD Home School for Adults in our business school and order our free general law CD package at the same time. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's the place to start. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. And that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about business here for the last couple of weeks. I started off with the bad news. I gave you all the bad news, and I said, okay, that ought to do you in for a while. And then I said, okay, now let's take a look at the good news. So last week I said, you know, outside of all this bad news that's going on around us, the world is full of good news. Good news. And I showed you what that good news was and what some of those solutions were. Now, I've said before, if you don't have a solution to the problem, then we don't need to sit here and jawbone about it. Don't need to sit here and talk about problems that don't have solutions. Such as, but not limited to, the sun is burning out. There isn't anything that you and I are going to do about the sun burning up, or burning out, or going dark. If it burns out, we all die. If it continues to burn, we all live. It's the end of the argument. So I don't need to sit here and jawbone about and go to school and learn a bunch of stuff about how the sun is burning up and blah, blah, blah. What I've got to be concerned about is, what am I going to do to put bread and meat and potatoes on the table for my bread snappers? You know, how do I pay the rent? Now, here at the law school, we get calls from all kinds of people from all over the world, and they tell us what's going on in their neck of the woods or in their neighborhood. And right now, the predominant number of calls coming in deal with the economy. I've lost my job, or I can't make ends meet, and I don't know what I'm going to do next, and blah, blah, blah. All right, so let's talk about what can you do to go out here in a down market and make money. And I've said before, you know, opportunity is like rain. It is everywhere. I don't care if you're in the middle of a depression, in the middle of the Sahara Desert, wherever you're at, there's opportunity there. The trick is in being able to recognize opportunity when you see it. Most people, when opportunity knocks, they don't see anything. They're just absolutely stonewall blind and can't see it. Now, what's the worst possible business that you could think about getting into right now? Just mull this over. Based upon what you're listening to with Katie Couric and the 6 o'clock news and Brian Williams and so on, what is the absolute worst possible business? Isn't it real estate? The real estate bubble has popped. Real estate values in the United States are going down in double-digit numbers every year. We're about 25% of the way to the bottom. Real estate brokers and salespeople are abandoning real estate sales and trying to find something else to do. I mean by the thousands. Mortgage brokers, people that have been involved, you know, in generating these mortgages, they're being laid off countrywide, is upside down, being bought out by Bank of America. I mean, the real estate news is so bad, so terrible, that it has got to be, here in the United States of America, it has got to be the worst possible business that you could think about going into. And yet, do you know that fortunes are being made right now in real estate? I mean fortunes. I mean millions of dollars are being generated in real estate right now. Right this minute. And I'm in real estate, and I'm still in real estate, and I'm still buying and selling and trading real estate. And I'm going to continue doing it. You know, just because somebody else can't make it doesn't mean I can't. Doesn't mean that you can't or somebody else can't. Let me tell you a little story here. It's in Reader's Digest, and I think it's this month's Reader's Digest. There's a guy in there called a Shark. And this guy is an old-timey mortgage broker, lives in Dallas, Texas. And some years back, this is when the market was still going up, he was writing mortgages, working for some company, working for wages, and writing mortgages. And he got to thinking about it, and he said, you know, this can't go on. This thing is going to pop one of these days, and I'm going to be unemployed, and I'm going to be out on the streets looking for a job. So he started analyzing the real estate market, and sure enough, the market peaked in June of 2005. That's where it hit the top. By the beginning of 2006, you know, you needed to be bailing out of the real estate market. If you were in real estate, you know, you needed to be getting out. And so, sure enough, this guy lost his job as a real estate mortgage writer. And so, he had a few bucks in his pocket, so he got to looking around. And so, he started buying distressed properties. Now, the conventional story works like this. People were buying houses for no money down. Remember back in 2000 and 2003 and 4 and 5 and so on. They'd go out here and they'd buy a $300,000 house using their credit and their credit score. And they'd hold onto that house for a year. And then they'd sell it for $325,000 or $350,000. And they'd make a little profit on that. And they'd go out and buy another house. And this time they'd pay $350,000 for the house, and they'd hang on to it for a year, and then they'd sell it for $400,000, and then they'd go out and buy another house for $400,000, and then they'd hold on to that for a year and sell for $450,000, and you know. And so the people were making money, and this is the euphoric period of bubble making. It's been going on for thousands of years. People used to buy tulip bulbs, for crying out loud. All right, now, ultimately, at some point in time, this thing reaches the saturation point. And the saturation point, and here's Bob Chapman coming to the fore now. Bob Chapman, remember, is the guy that writes the International Forecaster. And so he said this thing's about to top out and about to top out. And so he picked the top in June of 2005. Boys and girls, I don't know if the top is going to be in June of 2005 or October of 2009. I haven't got a clue. But I'm out here and I'm reading my, just like you, you know, I'm just reading the paper and watching Katie and Brian and doing my things. And so when he said he picked the top in June of 2005, I said to my wife, I said, we need to unload all real estate that we don't want. Anything that we don't want, we need to sell it. And so we did. past tense, you know, past tense. And so I got out at the top, and we had a little bit here, you know, not a great deal. You know, we're not millionaires. I'm not a Bill Gates. I'm just Joe Sixpack over here, but, you know, I figured this is probably the time to get out. And by golly, it was. By golly, well, Bob was right again. He's usually right, and so he's an old man. You know, he's older than I am. And so when you listen to these old men that have been around the block a few times, you get better advice than you do listening to young men. You know, people that are in their 30s, they really don't know a hell of a lot. Some guy that's 70 or 80, now that's some guy that you ought to be listening to. And so I listened to that guy. Well, listen, this guy in Dallas, Texas did the same thing. His story is in Reader's Digest. And so he went out and started buying distressed properties. Now, the distressed properties are not these $300,000-$500,000 houses that have now gone down by 25 or 30%. There's people out there buying those. They're out there buying the houses that were $450,000. They go down to $400,000, so they buy it. It goes from $400,000 to $350,000, and they buy it. They go up from $350,000 to $300,000, and they buy it. Hell, all you're doing there is just throwing your money away. You're just wasting your time, effort, and energy. You don't want to buy until the market reaches the bottom. But, you know, in many places, the market's at the bottom. It's at the bottom. Yeah, but it's not in these new houses and this luxury housing that's been built in the last 5 years. It's in the old Aunt Toby's. And we're back in the Depression years. Remember this? So, you go back here to the old Aunt Toby story. So here's what this guy's doing. The example they gave here was a house sold in 2002 for $98,000 in Detroit. The guy had it until about 2006 and couldn't keep up the payments, so he lost it. Now the bank has this house. It's what we call distressed. The bank's got it. It's an old house built around the turn of the century. You know, an oldie but a goodie. And this guy buys this house for $3,500 from the bank at auction. Cash money. Just walked into the auction. Somebody's going to get it. He bid $3,500. He put it on the market for $24,900 and sold it the next day. Now that's a business success story. You walk in, you buy it for $3,500, and you turn around and sell it for $25,000. You know, that's better than my 2% principle. Now, this guy does this, and he's in it in a big way. He's probably turning, you know, two or three houses a day. This guy's making millions. Hey, boys and girls, we don't need to make millions. We just need to make a living. Just need to make a living. Now, years ago, I used to do this in Oakland, California, which at that time was a city turning black. This is back in the 1960s and 70s. And there's a phenomenon called white flight. It's going on in Little Rock, Arkansas, as I speak. And so the white people are selling and moving as fast as they can, and the black people are trying to buy, but they can't afford it. And the banks won't lend to them because they haven't got good credit scores. I can sit there and say, well, that's discrimination. You can sit there and cry on your beer over discrimination, or you can take advantage of the status quo and the circumstances that are available and go out and make some money. So I start buying those houses. And I'd buy a house, for instance, here's one that I bought was for $12,000. Now, this house has to be brought up to FHA standards in order to sell it. And this house is going to sell based upon a certain formula, and the house was going to sell for $27,500. Never going to get a dime more, never going to get a dime less. That's what it's going to appraise for based upon the square footage. If the house can meet, I mean, you got to get a new certificate of occupancy. To give you an illustration, in those days you had to, all the water lines coming in from the water meter were half inch. Those had to be replaced with 3/4 inch service lines from the meter to the house. And if the house had a bad roof on it, you had to put a new roof on. So the amount of money that we would bid on a house would be based upon, well, what are we going to get out of it? So I took a look at the house. I said, it's going to cost me $5,000 to fix it. That told me how much to bid on it, and so I bid $12,000. 12 and 5 is 17. I sold it for $27,000. There was a $10,000 score in the house, so I made $10,000 less the cost of goods sold. Now, the $5,000 that I estimated to fix the house up was your direct cost, but there's indirect costs, you know. Little indirect little thingies over here. When I got all through, I netted about $5,000. But I did it in 90 days, and I did it in 1970 when $5,000 is probably worth, I don't know, two, three times what it is today. Now, I could do four houses like that a year. Now, that's $20,000 a year back in time when it was worth $40,000, $50,000. I could make my living easy just buying these old beat-out houses, bringing them up to code and selling them. And then you can do that today, and that's exactly what this guy's done. Except he's more sophisticated and has a bigger operation and has more people working for him and so on. Now, let's suppose you're an unemployed carpenter, plumber, electrician, you know, cement mason, whatever the heck you're doing, you know, or have been doing, and you find yourself unemployed. The people that are being evicted right now, which amounts to about 2 million people as I speak, 2 million people are going to lose these $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 houses. And they're going to be out on the streets, and they're going to be looking for, one, an apartment, or two, another house, or they're going to go live with Aunt Bessie or with Mom and Dad. But they're not going to stay in these, you know, these big new houses that they've been buying over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. Now, that's a big market. 2 million people are going out of those big houses, and they're going to go into something that they can afford. And in the inner cities, this is in Detroit now, and in these inner cities, there's all these houses everywhere, everywhere. Now, these people don't want to live there. See, they want to live in the suburbs. They want to live out in the suburbs 50 miles from their jobs where they can drive their SUVs and their Humvees at $5 and $6 a gallon gas here pretty shortly. But that isn't where reality is located. And while we're heading into this Great Depression like we were back in the 1930s, we haven't hit bottom yet. We're not even close to the bottom. And in the 1930s, it took 4 years, 3.5 years from October of 1929 to March of 1933 to hit the bottom. Then we skidded on the bottom for 4 more years. I would expect that that's what's going to take this time. It's going to take 3.5 years to hit the bottom. Now, it started in August of 2007. That's when this credit bubble hit us, August of 2007. So August of 2008 is coming up. That's your first year. August of 2009, second year. August of 2010 is the third year. So around January, February, March, something like that of 2011 is where we're going to hit the bottom. Then we should skid on the bottom, 2012, 13, 14, 15. Then maybe we'll start seeing some upticks, you know, like 2017, 18, 19, 20. Now, that's a long time. You know, we're talking about 10 years, and you just lost your job, Bob, so, you know, you got something you got to get out there and do. Now, you can cry in your beer, and you can draw your unemployment check and go down to the Blue Room and drink with the boys, or you can get off your dead hole, you know what, and get out there and go to work. And there's just tons and tons of things out there to do. Now, maybe real estate isn't your thing, you know, and I see these real estate guys, you know, on TV selling their books and one thing and another. And I call that mouse milk and snake oil. That guy isn't making money in real estate. He's making money selling books. Now, you know, we teach school here, and we teach business, and there's certain principles in business that emanate from the Bible, and we think that that's a better modality. So I told you in the last series of programs, I said, the good news is that there is a solution to our problem. It's the Ten Commandments model. The Ten Commandments model. And in Argentina, back in 2002, their economy collapsed, and they had 62% unemployment. In the 1930s, the maximum unemployment here in the United States is 25%, and that's the bad news. The good news is, when you have 62% unemployment, the good news is you have 38% employment, and that's the 38% that you want to sell to. When you have 25% unemployment, that's the bad news. The good news is 75% of people are employed, and those are the people you want to be selling to. See how simple that is? It's like buy low, sell high. It don't take a lot of brains to figure that out. Now, there's certain businesses out here that you're not going to go anywhere in, like Martha's Notions. In a depression, boys and girls, reality meets the road. And reality is that people are going to buy what they need, and they're not going to buy a lot of superfluous trash. Now, everybody needs food, clothing, and shelter, and that's why real estate is always good. But real estate at the top coming down is no good. Real estate at the bottom, where it can't go any lower. I mean, how much lower than $3,500 can you go? Now, how much is it going to cost to put that house back into condition? Now, this guy, you know, he took the house. It hadn't been vandalized. Now, there's a lot of houses out there that'll be vandalized. You know, people are going in there stripping the copper pipes and the wiring out. Now, they've got to be replumbed and rewired. You've got to price that into the amount that you're going to pay for it. What's it going to sell for? Now, that's kind of iffy. I don't know if this thing's going to sell for $25,000, but it went for about 25% of what it sold back in 2002. Now, here's a general rule of thumb that we go by. Now, listen up. Get your pen and paper out here. Let me show you what it is. You take the retail value of a property. In this case, it was $98,000 in 2002. What's its cash value? What is the cash value for that house? The answer is 25% of its maximum retail value. That's what its cash value is. All right? So the guy has got this thing on the market at $24,900. That's 25% of the $100,000 that it rounded off, you know, around $98,000, $100,000. So he's got it priced right. That house is going to sell all day long for $25,000. He's got to buy it for something less than that cash out of pocket. The bank needs to unload it, and the bank is going to unload it. And when the bank sells the house, they're going to sell it at auction. So you need to go to the auction, buy the house. And so when you buy the house, you're going to buy it for something less than the $25,000 that you're going to sell it for. Take a house over here that was selling for $500,000, $500,000. Now, what's its real cash value? $125,000. We're going to buy that house at auction for something less than $125,000. Now, here's another little rule of thumb when you're dealing in real estate. There are a whole lot more buyers out there at $25,000 than there is at $125,000. There's buyers out there at $125,000, no doubt about it. Hell, there's buyers out there at $500,000. But there's not nearly as many of them. So when you take 2 million people that are losing their homes, those are not $125,000 home buyers. Some of them will be, but not a lot of them. But boy, there's going to be all those people can afford $25,000. And they got to have some place to live. And now they're going to come down off their high horses and get off of those SUVs and the Humvees and the $300,000-$500,000 dream houses out in the suburbs, and they're going to come down to reality and buy those inner city houses. And that's where the money's going to be made in real estate. All right, now that's in the current Reader's Digest. Let me just go out and pick up a copy of the Reader's Digest, and that's the article on the shark, and here's the guy that got his picture in there. And he's an entrepreneur, and he's just out there. And do you think he's the only guy that's out there? I mean, out of 2 million houses, this guy, you know, he's going to do 100 houses a year. But hell, there's millions of those houses, and this is just the beginning of it. Chapman is predicting that over the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to see around 10 million foreclosures over the next 3 or 4 years. 10 million. Now, that's a lot of houses out there for all you carpenters and plumbers and electricians, all you craftsmen and tradespeople. Instead of working for some big corporation out here for $25, $30 an hour, Why don't you start thinking about buying and selling houses for yourself in a little small private business? Just work by yourself. How's that for a plan? You and your wife, you and a couple of teenage children, go out here, buy one of these trashy houses, and go rebuild the house. And in some neighborhoods, you know, the vandals will be coming in here stripping it out. I did a house one time years ago for a fellow named Bob Maurer. He bought it on 98th Avenue, which is about 6 blocks west of San Leandro, California. He paid $6,500 for it back about 1968, 69, 70, along in there somewhere. $6,500. He sold it for $18,500, as I recall. But we had to replumb that house about 3 times. I mean, the kids were in there stealing that copper pipe, you know, just as fast as we could put it in. And remember, you got to put in whatever the building code calls for. In those days, they call for copper steel pipe. And finally, we ended up forgetting the copper. Copper's fast, but we had to go in there and put steel pipe in because they'd steal the copper out of the house. That's in those kind of bad neighborhoods. But, you know, even those bad neighborhoods, you know, people have to live, don't they? You know, black people have to live someplace. And they can afford that $25,000, $30,000, $50,000 house. So I just wanted to point that out. Now let me tell you a funny little story here. This is called Start a Saloon. Now listen to this. For those of you who cannot stop drinking, consider starting a saloon in your home. You be the only customer, and you will not need a license. Give your wife $25 to buy a gallon of whiskey. There are 128 drinks in a gallon. Buy all of your drinks from your wife at $1.50 a drink. And in 4 days, when the gallon is gone, your wife will have $167 to save and $25 to buy another gallon. Now, if you live 10 years and you buy all of your booze from your wife and die with the shakes and the snakes in your boots, she'll have $152,387.50 saved. That's enough to bury you respectably, bring up your children, marry a decent man, and forget that she ever knew you. Now, that's a funny little story, but you know, that funny little story has a little moral behind it. It's called geometric progression. You know, we go out here and we spend our money down at Jake's, you know, or over at the Blue Room. And this buck and a half, you know, is back in the old days, you know, when I started drinking as a youngster, you know, a drink was 50 cents. Then it went up to a buck and a half. You know, now it's $7.50 in most bars. Now, you know, you're just throwing a lot of money away here, you know, drinking down at the Blue Room, and you'd do a little better if you'd drink at home. Or maybe quit drinking altogether. At least quit drinking for a while until you get some money together so that you can go out here and make some money and so you can go down to the bar and drink in style. Yeah, I got to give you a reminder here at about the halfway point. We're talking about 20 small private businesses. And you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. From the scriptural perspective, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, last item over here, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. And they don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about 20 small private businesses over here. So I just covered one of them over here. It's real estate. Real estate. Not as a broker. You can forget selling real estate as a broker or a salesman. That's a business. That's an occupation of the past. You can forget mortgage brokerage. You know, if you're a mortgage broker, you know, you can forget that. That isn't going to work. But here's a guy in the Reader's Digest, current issue, as I speak here, you know, it's either June, July, August, something like that. I just picked it up off the counter the other day. Somebody bought and brought it into the house here, and I was reading the Reader's Digest, and there's this neat story in here about a shark. Now, I've been in that business for years and years. It's always worked for me. It'll work for you. It'll work for anybody. Now, typically, if you're a housewife and you don't have any building skills, that's probably not going to be the business for you. You need to be a carpenter, a plumber, or electrician, or you need to be a handyman, somebody you know that can go in here and make some repairs. These houses typically need some repairs. Some don't. You know, some of them you can turn over right away, but you know, you got to be smart enough that, you know, if this thing needs a roof on it, do you know how much it costs to put a roof on, and can you put that roof on? Because if you got to go hire that job done, you got to go hire a roofing company to put this roof on. This is not the business for you. Or, you know, if you're not a roofer and you say, well, maybe what I better do here is back off of this one. Let's try this. Let's suppose that you don't have any money. Let me tell you about a deal that I did up in Boise, Idaho. When I first went up there, and I had a few bucks in my jeans, and a guy came to me and he said that he had this house, and it was a nice old Aunt Toby, and he had this house that he'd bought. He's a school teacher, and he owned it free and clear, but he didn't have any money with which to rebuild or renovate the house, and he didn't have the skills, the requisite skills. So he approached me, heard about me. I'm a contractor, and he'd heard about me. And so he said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Mr. Gordon. I don't have the money to rebuild it, but I own the house free and clear. I'll give you a lien on the house if you'll rebuild the house and get it ready for sale, and I'll split the proceeds with you 50-50. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't take a deal like that. I'd go out and buy my own house, and then I'd rebuild the house, and then I would take 100% of the proceeds. 100%. Now, a contractor is a unique animal. He's a prima donna, number one, but he's a unique animal. He's got feast and famine facing him every month. You know, he's either working and he can't keep up, or he's out of work and doesn't know what to do next. So I told this guy, I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll take your deal, because I could use that house to work on. Because at that time I had two guys working for me. I used to have 14. Remember, down in Oakland, I had 14 guys. When I got up to Boise, I woke up to that reality. That was a mistake. So I pared that thing down to just Jim Honey and Jess Sears. Two guys. Two good guys. But I had to keep Jess and Jim working. You know, these guys have to get their paycheck every Friday. And that means I got to write that check and I got to pay them every Friday, whether it rained on Wednesday or Thursday and they worked or didn't. And so I needed a place to put these guys on rainy days, inside on rainy days. So I told the guy this, I'll take the deal and I'll take half the profit, but I'm not going to do your house priority number one. I'm going to do your house in my spare time. I will work on that house when it's raining and I can't work outside. He took the deal. And so we signed up. It took me about, I don't know, probably a year to do that house. And I probably made about $5,000 on it, and he probably made about $5,000. But here was the important thing to me. It kept these two guys busy, and it kept me from having to spend money keeping these guys occupied and out of the bars, you know, on rainy days. And so it worked for me. It worked for the school teacher and blah, blah, blah. All right, now that's called a partnership deal. Let's suppose that you don't have a lot of money. And so what you do is you go out and you sharecrop. And this is an old principle that goes back into farming. Down in the South, there were landowners, white landowners, and they didn't want to work. And there were black people that didn't have any land. And so the black guy goes over to the white guy and he says, listen, you got the land and I got the labor. Let me go in here on your land and plant a crop. And you take 25% and I'll take 75%. And that's been a pretty steady source of income for people, you know, for thousands of years. And it's called sharecropping. Well, sharecropping doesn't work just for farmers. You know, sharecropping can work on all kinds of little deals where you don't have investment capital, but you got the labor, you got the know-how, you know what to do and how to do it. But what you need is somebody with money. Well, listen, there's people out there with money. And what you need to do is go down to the bar and start looking for somebody that's got a little money so that you can make a proposal. You know, you say, listen, I've got the labor and you've got the money and here's the deal. So you got to go out and start digging up some deals. And there's just deals everywhere. And you want to be careful that you don't take every deal. You want to be a cherry picker. You want to pick the deals that have got some money on them. Now remember, all you need to do is make about, you know, $2,000-$4,000 a month. So if you can take a house deal, or you can take an automobile, let me tell you another little story over here about a guy buying and selling and trading automobiles. And you can do this with anything. I don't care if it's boats. There's a market out there for boats. There just isn't a market out there for the boats that have been selling in the past. But there's a market out there for boats. And remember that the real cash value is 25% of its sale price. Whatever its regular, normal, everyday garden variety retail price is, its cash value is 25% of that, and you want to buy for something less. That's where your profit's at. The difference between what you buy it for and its real cash value. Now, pawnbrokers all deal in what's called real cash value. So if you take your diamond ring, and here's a deal that comes along quite often. People will call the law school and they'll say, well, I've got this gold watch, or I've got this diamond ring, or I've got this or that or something else. And sometimes people are offended, you know, when I tell them, well, you know, here's what the real value of that is. It's 25%. And one lady, she called up over here, and she paid $9,000 for this ring. Now, jewelry is like buying a new car. Well, you know, when you got a job and you're working and, you know, and you got plenty of money, you know, you don't think anything about going out here and paying $9,000 for a diamond ring. But I got to tell you that the guy that made that diamond ring, you know, the real cash value on that diamond ring was about $2,000. And that was the day that this lady bought it. Now, its real cash value out here in the marketplace is about 25% of the $2,000, which was the cash value the day she bought it. And that's because jewelry has a 3-keystone markup in it. 3 keystones. Now, a keystone markup is where you double the markup. So, in the trade, we call this a 3-mark item. Now, you take a look at a fair trade item like a gallon of milk, you know, it's got a 10% markup in it, and that diamond ring has about a $6,000 markup in it. So, jewelry is a bad buy, and a new car is just a kissing cousin to buying jewelry. Now, I buy jewelry. You know, I buy distressed jewelry. I buy cars and houses, you know, and things like that, or trade. You know, trade's a valuable way to do business also. And we'll talk about barter here in a little bit. In fact, barter is actually a better way to do business than with money or with cash. And better tax-wise, better for you, better for everybody. And it's just that it's more cumbersome, more difficult to put deals together, but barter and trade is a hell of a good way to do business, a good way to make money, a good way to make cash conversion. So keep in mind that there are deals out there in jewelry, but, you know, when somebody says that they paid $9,000 for a ring, I'll give you a little story here. My wife took a ring in one time that a guy paid $80,000 for, $80,000. And she took it in and trade, and then just out of for a lark, she took it in to Joe Maxson in Springfield. Nice diamond. It was a two and a quarter or 2.5 carats. One of those rectangular diamonds and a ring, and it had two rubies, one on each side. And it had two other rings, one ahead of it and one behind it, that snapped together. The three, it was really a unique ring. And three rings is what it was. And the three of them snapped together. It was an engagement ring and a wedding ring. And then I guess an added ring, I don't know. But the three snapped together. It was a very unique design. And this guy had it made. The guy had money, and he paid $80,000 to have it made. Do you know what that ring was worth when I took it into Joe and said, "Hey, Joe, what do you think you're going to give me for this?" And $20 bills on the counter. He said, $6,000. He looked at it. He graded the diamond. He said, "You know, it isn't the best diamond in the world." And he said, "I'll give you $6,000. I said, "Okay, well, thank you very much." So I went down to Zales in Battlefield Mall. I didn't take the ring down there. I described to the salesman what it was that I wanted. I said, "I need about a 2.25 carat, one of these rectangular cuts over here with two rubies on each side of it. And I'd like an engagement ring and a ring in front. I want three rings together, and I want them to snap together." And he said, "Yeah, we'll make that for you." You know what the price was? $27,000. So I got a bid from Zales. Now listen, that's $27,000 from Zales to make what I described to him. He said, "Okay, we can do it." No, what Joe said, "I'll give you $6,000 for it." Well, Joe's going to buy it used, 6, 12, 18, 24. He's going to actually offer cash money, $20 bills across the counter, 25% of what Zales, you know, round numbers, is going to build it for. Now, this is off, you know, 1982 is when this guy had this ring made, and I took it in about 1990. Now, 10 years later, when the jewelry market was really off. Remember, we had that recession through the Bush years? And it was right in that recession, 1990, 91, 92, long in there. And so here's this $80,000 ring, you know, back in the 1980s, when boom times are gone, and when it's custom made, and then here's what its value is. All right, now, there's people out there that are buying jewelry. But you got to know what you're doing. I mean, you know, you got to pay your dues. You got to know something about jewelry. And typically, people in a pawn shop do that. So the guys in the pawn shops, you know, they're not starving to death. The people in the pawn shops are not calling me on the phone telling me that they lost their jobs and that they're willing to work for food. They're making money every day of the week. All right, now let me tell you something here about automobiles. Automobiles is another neat business I didn't know much about until the one time a guy named Wally Hitt. He used to work for Crown Zotterbeck. And this guy takes early retirement. And then 3 years after he takes early retirement, Zotterbeck goes upside down, or at least their pension plan did, and now he took retirement at 55. He's 58 years old, no income. Can't get Social Security. He's got no income, and by now he's moved from Boise to Orlando, Florida. So I said, "Well, listen, Wally, why don't you tell me what you're doing down here? I happen to be down in Orlando." And he said, "Well, I'm out here buying and selling, trading cars." Now, Wally was a salesman. Wally was a salesman. Now, he'd never sold cars in his life, but he'd been selling paper, you know. And so he's out here selling paper and doing his thing, and he made a good living, you know, made plenty of money. Just normal Joe Sixpack over here, but now all of a sudden he's out of work. And he's running out of money is what he's doing. So he's selling stuff off, and he had a Pinto car. I forgot what year it was, 72, 3, 4 Pinto. At the time, it was 10 years old, 12, you know, it was an old, you know, beater, as we call it. And so he put it on the market for $1,500. He put a little ad on the laundromat bulletin board. Pinto car, $1,500. Now, it's on the bulletin board here for a few days, and pretty soon, guy comes by and buys it from him for $1,500. So now Wally has sold one of his cars, and he's got $1,500, probably pay the rent and a couple things. And so all of a sudden, he's getting more calls for the Pinto, and he says, oh, I got to go down and take that sign down. He goes down to the laundromat to take the sign down. Talk about serendipity now, see? And while he goes in here to take the sign down, he sees another sign on there for a Pinto car, very similar to his, for $1,200. $1,200, not $1,512. Now, Wally is sitting here with $1,500 in his pocket. He sees another car over here, just like his or similar to it, close to it. And out of a lark, just on a lark, he says, I think I'll go look at that car. So he goes over to this guy's house, takes a look at the car, and the car for $1,200 is better than the car he just sold for $50. So on a lark, he offers the guy $1,000 cash, whips out the money out of his pocket and says, I'll give you $1,000 cash for it right now. That's $200 less than he's asking for it, and it's a better car than he just sold for $1,500. And the guy took him up on it. He says, okay, I'll take $1,000 cash for it. And so Wally drives out with another Pinto car. Goes back home, Lee puts his sign back up, takes this other guy's sign down, and sells it for $1,500. And that launched him on his car career. He had never thought about buying and selling automobiles. He didn't know anything about them. He's just like me. I'd be very, very reluctant to get into cars because I know so little about them. You know, I'm just a greenhorn when it comes to cars. So if you're an auto mechanic and you know a little something about cars and you can fix them up, let me tell you another little story here. The other day, my boy is looking through the internet. You know, he's our computer man here, and he's looking through the internet. And this is a couple of years ago, but he's looking for, you know, just anything, and he stumbles across some website someplace. It's a little town in southeastern Kansas, not too far from Joplin, which isn't too far from me. You know, I could drive over there to Joplin, you know, in 3 hours probably. And this town is over in Kansas, which is probably another hour away or so. So about 4 hours away from me, this town's got 6 2002 Ford Crown Victoria police cars that they're auctioning off. Now, these cars, I told Dirk, I said, now you keep track of those cars and see what they sell for. And I said, look it up and see what they're worth. And he said, well, they're worth about $11,500 wholesale. Those cars sold for $2,600 each. Now, when you buy these cars at an auction, you don't know whether the engine's blown up. If you're buying it, you know, just by looking at the picture, long distance like that, you got to be somewhat knowledgeable. I mean, I don't know, 2002. And these cars were probably 3 years old. This is probably 2005 or 6. That was a couple 3 years ago. Now, could you buy a car for $2,600 cash and sell that car for $5,500 cash, make a Keystone markup in that car? Could you do that? Because, you know, cities buy these cars brand new from the Ford Motor Company. They run them for 2 or 3, 4 years. Did you know that the Highway Patrol here in Missouri auction off all the cars that they buy? Now, the state... Every state in the union auctions off their cars and their trucks. Their Department of Transportation is on. You can get on these bid lists. I mean, do you want to bid on Army surplus? Do you want to bid on state surplus? You know, there are people that do that and make a living at it. There used to be a program that was on years ago, and the moral to the story of this was, it was called What's My Line? And people would come on there, and you had to guess. You know, the panel would try to guess what this guy did for a living. And some of these people had the craziest jobs, some of the craziest businesses, some of the craziest ways for making a living that you could dream up. And that's what entrepreneurial business is all about. It's find a need and fill it. And that's what old Henry Kaiser wrote on his dump truck. Henry Kaiser had a sign, I don't know if he still does or not, but he used to, on all of his concrete trucks, it would say, find a need, just three words. And you know, on a cement truck, the barrel was rolling all the time. And when the barrel rolled over to the other side, it said, and fill it. Six words, find a need and fill it. That was Henry Kaiser's advice to the young people. He said, find a need and fill it. Now, all of these cities, all of these states have a need to get rid of all of this surplus material. The Highway Patrol is not going to be driving 1998 Ford Crown Victorias. They're going to be driving 2009s. Now, they might keep them for 2 years or three, but they're not going to be driving old beaters. They're going to be driving new cars. So the police departments, fire departments, well, the fire departments, they don't sell their fire trucks. They keep those for years and years. But the police department, they sell all their police cars. And those police cars go out at rock bottom prices. You bid on them. And maybe you win the bid, maybe you don't. But a car that's worth $11,500 wholesale, you can just about bet that what somebody's going to do is they're going to buy that. You know, it's going to be a Ford dealer. He's going to buy that car for $2,600, take it in, rework it, and then put it on the market for about $18,000-$20,000. Now, that's what the Ford dealer's business is. Now, if the Ford dealer can do that, can you do that? Because he's going to go out there in the marketplace and bid on that car just like you're going to bid. So there's opportunity out there. Now you might be sitting there saying, well, yeah, but I can't buy and sell real estate and because I'm not a carpenter, and I can't buy and sell cars because I'm not a mechanic. Well, okay, well, keep listening, because I said I'll cover 20 small private businesses as we progress along, and surely there's got to be something in here that you can do, or that you can learn to do. Something that you can buy. An old business associate of mine said, you know, Gordon, what you want in life, in business, in your business life, you want something that's very, very valuable, that's in a very small box. Very, very valuable in a very small box. At the time, I was in the furniture business, and I had a truck and trailer. And my truck and trailer, high cube trailer, would hold about, you know, normal Friday delivery truck, about $25,000 worth of goods in it. If I really larded it on, I might get $30,000 on my truck and trailer. And one day, we were in his office down in Salt Lake City, and the friar and I were talking, and he looked out the window and he said, you see that van out there in the parking lot? I looked out, and then it was a brand new van. He just bought it. Brand new. He said, I just bought that van, and then it was $11,000. And I thought, wow, $11,000. This is quite a few years ago when a new van was, you know, $11,000. And it was more than my poor old tired blood could handle. And then he said, here's the surprising part. That van is loaded. And he said, do you know how much money is in that van in electronics equipment? I said, no. And he said, I got $35,000 worth of stuff in that van. I've got three times more money sitting inside that van than the van is worth. And then he said, Gordon, you got a truck and trailer sitting out there in that parking lot. And then you got about $25,000 in a truck and trailer. He said, I got $35,000 in a van. And that registered on me, and I said, wow. And so I could see the value of what you want is you want a lot of value in a small, compact area. So you farmers out there, you know, you load up a truckload of corn, and you got 40,000 pounds of corn in this truck. 40,000 pounds. That's 20 tons. Now, corn, as I speak, is worth about, I don't know, it's not quite $8, but I'm going to round it off to $8 a bushel. Now, if you've had 40,000 pounds divided by 60 pounds to the bushel, that's 666 bushels times 8 is $5,333 sitting in an $80,000 truck, and that's without the trailer. You know, you farmers out there, if you've got a new truck and trailer, you got a $100,000 rig hauling $5,000 worth of corn. And my old buddy Fryer, he's sitting here with an $11,000 van, brand new van, with $33,000 or $35,000 worth of electronics equipment and, you know, stereos and stuff like that. And I'm sitting out here with a furniture truck with about $25,000 worth of stuff in it. See where we're going with this? You know, there's some things over here, like a pawn shop guy, you know, offering a guy, you know, $1,000, $1,500 for his diamond ring that he paid, you know, $9,000 for. The pawn shop guy takes that ring for $900 when you don't redeem it, or $1,000 or $2,000, and he sells that for double. In other words, every time he's doing business, he seeks to double his money. Now, the real estate guy that I started today's program on, he bought a house for $3,500 and sold it for $24,900. How many keystones did he put into that? Well, you know, you take $25,000 and divide that by $3,500, and he made seven times his investment capital. Seven times. He invested $3,500 and then turned around and sold the house the next day for seven times what he paid. It's what we call a sweetheart deal. But buying it for X amount and selling it for double isn't a sweetheart deal. That's common business. Hey, I'm about out of time here, children. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily, worldwide, over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can all be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.